Okay, you're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of October 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London, with me, Robert Bounds. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, does Switzerland support the Belarusian dictator? Despite not being allowed into the country, he's been allowed to set up a business there. We'll find out why. And the second round of Brazilian mayoral elections were held yesterday, with 50 cities choosing their mayors. Our resident Brazilian, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, will be telling us what happened. Fernando, were the results to your liking?
Very much so. Good to see new blood in São Paulo.
And we'll also be talking to Barrett Austin from the Eye of the Storm in New York City and heading to a food festival in Turin.
People overseas see the marketability of the Italian food brand. People put Italian flags on products and call it, let's say, provolone or salami when it's not actually anything like the traditional product. You know, the consumer maybe is in a hurry. They buy it off the shelf. They see the Italian flag and yet they're being duped.
All that, plus we'll play some great music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, it's time for the news headlines with Roger Crisp.
Monocle 24 News. Greek journalist Kostas Vashivanis, editor of Hot Doc magazine, is on trial for violating data privacy laws. He published and named more than 2,000 wealthy Greeks with Swiss bank accounts and claimed today in court that he was only doing his job. He could face up to 2 years in prison if convicted. Vashivanis' lawyer, Haris Economopoulos, said the state should have thanked his client for having the courage to publicise the document rather than prosecute him and rejected the accusation of privacy violation.
This is a case that has grave concern for the public interest, the freedom of press. In grave circumstances, in times when you're disclosing the truth, or at least you're disclosing documents that are being allegedly researched by any and all public authorities that we know, the financial prosecutors are seeking this document. The procurator of Athens had been seeking this document. Instead of the journalist being thanked for being able and having the courage to publicize this document.
Hurricane Sandy has begun hitting the U.S. East Coast today with fierce winds and driving rain. About 50 million people from the mid-Atlantic to Canada are in the path of the nearly 1,000-mile-wide storm. Forecasters say this could be the largest to hit the mainland in U.S. history. Flooding is expected to be the biggest problem, and already doors and subways are heavily blocked with sandbags. Tourists and residents alike in New York have made their choices.
When you are in the hotel, the people of the hotel says when you're in the hotel, there's food, there's drink, there's everything.
I'm checking it out. You know, you're not safe anyway. You know, right? I was going to go to Long Island. My brother got evacuated.
You know, when it comes to life, you know, everything, you know, takes a risk, you know. But I'm a bit, you know, concerned.
Right now, you know, we're going to stay here, so we should be fine. We're here for the last one as well. It wasn't a big problem.
In Syria, a four-day truce brokered by Lakhdar Brahimi has failed to hold as hostilities barely paused. Today, a car bomb in Damascus killed 10 people, including children. Mr. Brahimi says he was worried by the broken truce, but added that there are no plans to send peacekeepers into Syria.
The United Nations and the Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping has explained this a few days ago, is doing their normal work, doing some contingency planning. If and when the Security Council decides to send a peacekeeping mission as part of their efforts to help the Syrian people, then DPKO will be ready.
The South African government is to sign up to an initial $5.4 billion worth of clean energy products, allowing it to reduce reliance on coal-fired plants. The government has selected 28 wind and solar projects in the first stage of the programme, with the contracts expected to be signed on the 5th of November. Although election monitors in Ukraine say the country's election was a backward step for democracy, the Ukrainian Prime Minister, Mykola Azarov, has already hailed a decisive win for the ruling party of President Viktor Yanukovych. Monocle's correspondent in Kiev, Gulliver Cragg, told today's edition of The Globalist that they will nonetheless be disappointed by the projected margin of victory.
It rather shows that Ukrainians aren't very happy with him at all, because when you consider the advantage that Yanukovych's party had in terms of the media and in terms of the amount of pressure that they were able to put on voters, and the advertising resources that they had for this campaign, they've still at best won the confidence of half of the Ukrainian population, and also considering that one of the main opposition leaders, Yulia Tymoshenko, is in prison, and the various other disadvantages that opposition forces had.
The World Customs Organization has revealed that a huge enforcement operation across East and West Africa in July has seized 82 million doses of illegal medicines. The operation was conducted across 16 major African seaports. The medicines are thought to be worth a total of more than $40 million. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
All right, thanks, Roger. It's 5 minutes past 6 p.m. here in London, and you're tuned in to Midori House on Monocle 24. And you are listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. Now, the president of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, presides over what has been described as the last dictatorship in Europe. He and his ministers are prevented from travelling to EU countries as a condition of sanctions that also restrict exports of some raw materials from Belarus. Despite all this, it seems that a new company will be established in Switzerland next year that could provide an outlet for Lukashenko's potassium, one of the key products prone to sanctions. So why is Switzerland apparently willing to host this company, despite Lukashenko's reputation and continuing claims of human rights violations by Minsk? And how is it possible for such a character to so transparently get the better of measures that are trying to change the character of the country? Joining me on the line from Lucerne is Simon Greuter, political specialist and former political advisor on Belarus at the Council of Europe. Simon, thanks for joining us on Midori House.
You're welcome.
Now, first of all, we should ask if there's any sort of morality in the decision for Switzerland to allow Lukashenko's company to set up business.
Well, first of all, I don't know if there actually was at all any decision yet of the Swiss government to allow this company, because I think even the company doesn't exist yet. There was a decision of these Belarus Kali and the Ural Kali companies to create this joint venture, Soyuz Kali. Mm-hmm. And this joint venture is now still undergoing several procedures, including antitrust and anti-monopoly procedures, before it can be legally established. And yes, according to the news that we get, there is an intention of this company to be registered in Switzerland, and that would be the earliest point where the Swiss authorities could react on such a request of registration. So at the moment there is no decision. There is an intention which was voiced by the authorities of Belarus and by the responsibles of this joint venture company, which is in establishment. But yes, there should definitely be a political discussion in Switzerland about this question, and to be prepared when the question really asks itself concretely.
So at the moment, perhaps we're talking about an intention rather than something concrete. But what are the foreign relations? What are the policies of Lukashenko that have stopped him or made him a sort of persona non grata across the rest of the European Union?
Mr. Lukashenko is now personally under sanctions, and a lot of his key members of his regime, because of the human rights violations that are happening in Belarus. First of all, situation seemed to improve a little bit in 2010, but then in December 2010, at the presidential elections, one could say that he showed his real face and brutally cracked down the opposition activists, political opposition, and civil society activists who demonstrated against the way the elections were done. And currently there are several political prisoners in Belarus. And Belarus is also the last country in Europe which practices the death penalty. So these are the main reasons why Belarus is the last country in Europe which is not a member of the Council of Europe and which is under this type of sanctions.
Okay, Simon, and is Lukashenko sort of on the lookout for places in order to set up new businesses outside of the country, outside of Belarus? I mean, is he getting strapped for cash? Does he need to sort of fiddle some rules and pull some strings in order to get his products out there, the raw materials of Belarus?
Definitely, every country who produces and has resources, natural resources, and produces raw materials, they are interested to export. They're already currently, they're exporting, for instance, this potash.
The potassium.
Potassium, they are already exporting, but of course they're looking for ways to improve the export channels, to improve prices and to get other preferential treatments, to improve for instance, better tax regulations or to have better access to credits, to international credits, and to they also probably want to benefit from hands-on, straightforward regulations in terms of business registrations, etc. That's probably why they have the plan to register this this company in Switzerland.
And it's obviously very embarrassing for Switzerland, Simon, isn't it? I mean, this part of the reason, presumably, that he wants to sell this raw material is to fund, in part, one of the sort of key parts of his dictatorship, which is his secret police force. As you said, this is one of the major kind of points of his sort of anti-EU or his sort of humanitarian problems. It's a pretty embarrassing thing, isn't it, when one country has a moral stance, but it's allowed to let a potential company open like this.
Yes, it's definitely a political discussion that needs to take place. Of course, this financing of secret police is that's not the only source of financing that the Belarusian state has. But of course, the problem is the one with secret accounts and with lack of transparency in all these accounts. So when working with Belarusian companies and especially state companies like Belarus Kali, there is of course always a very high risk that that the regime benefits from this situation to hold itself in power, to continue manipulating elections, to continue depressing civil society, and that would be really indeed embarrassing for Switzerland if basically, Lukashenko could find a way to kind of put down the profile of this company as a Belarusian company, to make it a bit more international with a seat in Switzerland, to have better access to credits, etc.
Yeah. All right. Well, for the time being, Simon Greuter, thank you very much for joining us. That was Simon Greuter, former political advisor on Belarus at the Council of Europe.
As the countdown to the US elections continues, Monocle 24 is heading to America for a series of election specials. Every day until election day itself, Midori House will be coming to you live from New York City. I'll be joined by a host of political guests for an hour of news, debate and analysis on the world's most exciting elections. So join us every day on Midori House for Monocle 24's election specials. I'm Steve Bloomfield, and I approve this message.
Second Cycle is a special kind of upscaling that understands consumers' connection to objects with a personal history. Monocle Films travel to Helsinki to watch Finnish furniture brand Artek hunt down old items and bring them back to life.
It was quite an emotional thing for all of us. When we went through the flea markets and schools and kindergarten from where we bought these things, we took them to our office and our employees started to say that Mirko, don't do anything to them. Don't touch them, don't hurt them. Let them be as they are.
You can watch this Second Cycle film and many more films in the programs menu on monocle.com.
All All right, that was a nice quick one. It's 18:14 here in London and you're tuned in to Midori House. Yesterday, Brazilians went to the polls to vote in the country's second round of mayoral elections. With 16 different political parties governing Brazil's 85 biggest cities, we decided to bring our resident Brazil expert, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, to walk us through who won what. Fernando, welcome to Midori House.
Hello, Rob. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Thanks for making the short trip down the stairs to Studio One. Now, first things first. Your home city, São Paulo?
Of course, which is actually the biggest city in Brazil, so the most important dispute that we had yesterday.
So fresh blood, I hear.
Fresh blood. And I kind of like it. I think the city needed that. And he's the Workers' Party candidate. And it's funny because you say, oh, the Workers' Party is so popular around Brazil, but not in São Paulo. São Paulo is very common that the center-right, PSDB, they always win there. It's kind of their safety state. But this time, Lula chose Fernando Haddad, which is a complete... He never was candidate for mayor or for any other political... as an MP or anything. And actually, he won. He was on the third place in the beginning of the race. But then Lula showed his support with Dilma as well. And that kind of paid off.
And in terms of the sort of governance of Brazil, in the intro there, we talked about Brazil's 85 biggest cities. It's clearly a gargantuan country to have 85 of its biggest cities being decided upon. What's the kind of atmosphere like? I mean, you've obviously been scanning the Brazilian media a lot to research this story for us and all the rest of it. But I mean, is there a sort of febrile excitement about the mayoral elections, like maybe there is for the presidential elections? I mean, is it that big a deal? I mean, is it about local government or is it just about the cities?
I think it's a big deal, and I think this year especially, I think it's kind of like a preview for the 2014 presidential elections, and what the results show to me, because you know we're having the main salon, which is our biggest corruption scandal ever, and people said, oh, this will be terrible for the Workers' Party. It was not terrible at all, to be honest. Actually, the Workers' Party improved because they were very smart. They did change, as I said, about new blood. They completely changed, they chose like new politicians, people who were definitely not involved in this case. So I think that was an intelligent decision made by Lula and Dilma. And the opposition, they're not doing very well. I mean, as I said, PSDB, they lost São Paulo.
This is the PSB. This is...
The names are very similar. PSDB is the party of José Serra, the right-wing candidate. I'm going to talk about PSB.
We've got PSB as well.
Yeah, that's...
Man, if they were companies, you'd end up buying the wrong thing, wouldn't you?
It's very complicated.
I wanted to ask you about this PSB. We talked about this before we switched on the microphones. This is a new party. This is Eduardo Campos.
Exactly.
And they've done quite well, haven't they, to come from sort of nowhere to somewhere at least.
Actually, they're the party with the highest number of capitals, because in Brazil we have 27 states, and each state has a capital. And this time PSB have 5 capitals out of the 27, including important ones like Belo Horizonte and Recife. And actually, Eduardo Campos is the leader of the party. He's the current governor of Pernambuco, which Recife is the capital of Pernambuco. Sorry if I'm saying so many names.
And where is Recife? This is up in the sort of north.
I'll show you here in this
corner,
colorful map in front of me. It's in the north.
Yeah, yes, I got it right.
You see? You're very good at Brazil.
I was meant to get a long bus ride up there one day years ago.
It's funny because PSB usually is kind of an ally of the Workers' Party, but this time they're working more as an independent party. Mm-hmm. So I believe Eduardo Campos will try to become president in 2014. Not sure if he'll beat Dilma, which is still the clear favorite, but he definitely has a chance. And they have more or less the same ideological views. They're on the left. So basically, actually, the right are not doing very well in Brazil at the moment.
And I was in Brazil a couple of months ago to do a media story for the magazine, and I was in São Paulo and in Rio, and there's a big difference between those two cities. Mm-hmm. Obviously, one's gargantuan, one's just massive, but they both had a very different vibe. And the Palestinians and the Cariocas define themselves very differently. Is that borne out in its politics? I mean, can we see the different sorts of people that live in the different cities by who they vote in?
For sure. I mean, I'm not saying São Paulo is not a liberal and progressive city. It is in some ways, but I think people in Rio de Janeiro, they're kind of more open. For example, I remember in the presidential elections in 2010, Marina Silva, the Green Party candidate, she was the second place in Rio. She got like 30% of the vote, if I'm not wrong, And that's impressive for a Green Party candidate. Uh-huh. And so they can be quite progressive. And this year, even though Eduardo Paes was re-elected, was very easily, he got like more than 60% of the vote. The second candidate was from the far left, was not even left. You know what I mean? So, yeah. And São Paulo can be quite conservative sometimes, you know? And
so well, could not, you say that perhaps São Paulo represents the rest of the country a bit more than Rio does? Rio is a little bit more out on a limb politically. Maybe very interesting because of it, but maybe it doesn't, it's not necessarily representative of the country. Country of Brazil as a whole.
Yeah, I think so. And but I would say as well that São Paulo can be more conservative than the rest of the country. And yeah, but I'm happy that this conservatism is stopping. I mean, São Paulo needed some fresh air.
I think. I'm looking at that map that you've got in front of you there, yeah, just to wrap up. It's an interesting thing. It seems, you know, when we're talking, we just heard Steve's promo for his US election shows in the UK. Obviously, we've got a coalition, which is a very unusual thing, where there are three parties, where there are two parties running a government and one in opposition. There are so many, it seems to me that there are a hell of a lot of political Brazilian parties. I remember when I was in Brazil, the mayoral, there were so many notices coming out for the mayoral candidates, just in the state of Rio, where I was at that time. There's a huge amount of people running.
Far too many.
Is it a very political country? Does it seem like that?
Exactly, but I have a feeling that because that we have so many parties, that's why we have so many corruption scandals. Because then for you to make a coalition, it's basically impossible. So that's why sometimes there was this scandal Mensalão, where the government actually they paid for them to vote for their issues. Of course, that's completely wrong. But in a country like Brazil, so many parties, that's so much easier to happen than when you have, like, in the UK, like the Conservatives and the Labour Party, or in the US. So maybe it would be a better idea to have less parties.
There seems to be a lot of parties that probably get three votes. You know, there's sort of 1,000 parties that get three votes.
Exactly. Look at the map. Every single state has a different color from a different party. It's crazy.
I wish I could make a joke about how much I love Brazilian parties, but I think we'll have to end it there before I ruin the tone of this political discussion.
But we do like the parties.
Exactly,
in Brazil,
of course we do. For the time being, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you for joining us on Midori House.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we're going to be having lunch in a windy New York City. All right, and you're tuned in to Midori House with me, Robert Bound. We're going to New York now, where Monocle researcher Barrett Austin is holding up in his apartment, waiting for Hurricane Sandy. Barrett, thanks for taking the time to join us for lunch on Midori House.
Of course, Rob. Great to speak with you. Haven't been blown away yet here, so things are looking good right now.
Yeah, what's happening? I mean, what's the feeling on the ground? But I mean, you're all probably bunkered down there, aren't you?
I think so. I mean, it's very quiet at the moment. We're not experiencing any of the drama that we're sort of expecting in the next couple of hours. You go out on the streets, and by and large, it's quiet. You know, there's really not a whole lot going on in the streets. Most of the shops have closed. Wall Street has shut down for today. They'll also be shut down for tomorrow. So in many ways, the city seems to have come to a standstill.
This is going to be like the war, isn't it, where sort of the birth rate sort of went up massively in one week in New York City in early November in 2012. It seems like that's going to be one of those things where everyone's locked inside.
I think it's absolutely possible, especially given that this is sort of the Halloween weekend. And if you look at what some of the people have been dressed as for the past couple of days, sort of everyone walking around very scantily clad, I would say that wouldn't surprise me at all if we do see the birth rate start to shoot up about 9 months from now.
We better not dress too scarily. What about the sort of local government? What about the fire services? What's happening? We heard in our own news bulletin at the top of the show that obviously there's a lot of sandbagging of subways and stuff like that. What does it look like?
Well, of course, local government, they're taking it very seriously. In the past couple of years, you've had both Governor Cuomo and Mayor Bloomberg take a lot of heat for sort of mishandling snowstorms. And then last year, there was, you know, a pretty decent emergency response with Hurricane Irene, which, of course, did less damage than this storm is expected to do. But, you know, they're taking it very seriously. The subway and the buses, you know, public transit, it all shut down around 7 o'clock last night, so no one's really getting around from point A to point B. You've got around 350,000 residents in the city's so-called flood zone A, which I actually live just a few blocks from. So fortunately, I can stay. But, you know, essentially you've got 350,000 residents in this city that have been urged to evacuate and sort of seek refuge on higher ground. So it's something that everyone's taking very seriously. If you were to go outside right now, the weather's just a bit funny. It's very ominous. It's not so bad, but you know, the idea is that a couple of hours from now, things could get quite severe.
Yeah, there seems to be a bit of sort of gallows humour, sort of scanning some of the social networks and things. Seems to be a lot of kind of glib remarks, which I guess everybody makes, where everyone sort of laughs a little bit when they're scared. But where you say that you're in flood zone A. That sounds a bit ominous, Barrett. I hope you're obviously going to be all right. What is that? Is that where the sort of point of the thing is going to hit? We've heard a lot about Atlantic City and Staten Island and further up the coast of Rhode Island and stuff. But do you know where the sort of brunt is expected to be?
You know, it's obviously very difficult to say, but being that we are just a couple of hours out, I think the storm is expected to make landfall maybe around sort of just after nightfall. The idea is that it's going to hit southern New Jersey. And if you look at television footage, there's already massive flooding. If you look at Atlantic City sort of along the boardwalk there, the water, you know, is already much, much higher than it typically would be. So I think landfall will probably come right on the shores of New Jersey. But that doesn't mean that everyone else will be spared. I think you've got tropical storm force winds reaching out about 500 miles on both sides of the eye of the storm. So basically everyone from Georgia up as far north as Maine and into Canada really, you know, is going to be feeling the effects of this for the next couple of days.
All right, and finally, before we go, and I know it's a big subject and one you're interested in yourself, but we'll try and keep it brief, Barrett. The politicking surrounding this obviously is only a few days to go before you guys vote for your new president or your incumbent president. What is that being borne out in sort of storm talk?
It's something that I think both candidates they're wise not to make political hay of a natural climactic disaster. I think it's something that's it's being in in media circles it's being discussed, but I don't think many of the candidates are really making too much hay of it. I think that if a lot of people are asking who benefits from this, and it's difficult to assume that Romney would benefit from this at all. He's had some sort of political momentum traction in recent days, but there's nothing to take away. There's nothing better to take away the attraction, from Romney than a natural disaster like this. Obviously, President Obama has had the opportunity to give a press conference just about an hour ago. So I think that if someone benefits from this, it's President Obama, assuming that he handles the situation effectively. Otherwise, it's something that the Republicans will, by all means, seize upon with just over 1 week before America goes to the polls.
All right, Barrett. Well, listen, for the time being, thank you for joining us. Take care of yourself and also happy birthday. I'm going to now unironically play Do the Whirlwind by Architecture in Helsinki. And that was Do the Whirlwind by Architecture in Helsinki. In the next half hour of the show, we'll talk to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, about his experience on the worst airline in the world. But first, here's Roger Crisp with the news headlines.
Thanks, Robert. Greek journalist Kostas Vashavanis, editor of Hot Doc magazine, is on trial for violating data privacy laws. He published and named more than 2,000 wealthy Greeks with Swiss bank accounts and claimed today in court that he was only doing his job. He could face up to 2 years in prison if convicted. Hurricane Sandy has begun hitting the US East Coast today with fierce winds and driving rain. About 50 million people from the mid-Atlantic to Canada are in the path of the nearly 1,000-mile-wide storm. Flooding is expected to be the biggest problem, and already doors and subways are heavily blocked with sandbags. In Syria, a four-day truce brokered by Lakhdar Brahimi has failed to hold as hostilities barely paused. Today, a car bomb in Damascus killed 10 people, including children. Mr. Brahimi says he's worried by the broken truce, but added that there are no plans to send peacekeepers into Syria.
The South African government is to sign up to an initial $5.4 billion worth of clean energy products, allowing it to reduce reliance on coal-fired plants. The contracts are expected to be signed on the 5th of November. Although election monitors in Ukraine say the country's election was a backward step for democracy, the Ukrainian Prime Minister Mykola Azarov has already hailed a decisive win for the ruling party of President Viktor Yanukovych. And the World Customs Organization has revealed that a huge enforcement operation across 16 seaports in East and West Africa in July has seized 82 million doses of illegal medicines, worth a total of more than $40 million. And those are the headlines here on Monocle 24.
OK, thank you, Roger. It's 18:32 here in London and you're tuned in to Midori House. It's usually pretty easy to think of a reason to be sorry. One is not in Italy, and it's even easier right now than it is usually. The ninth edition of the Salone del Gusto, the trade fair of the slow food movement, has been underway these last few days in Turin. Earlier, Andrew Miller caught up with our man in Milan, Ivan Cavallo, in one of the lucky people in attendance.
There's been some nice samplings of salami and homemade bread and some wine. So I think today you should be jealous.
How big a thing is this? How many exhibitors turn up and what do they exhibit and who attends and why, apart from the salami?
It's a Biennale thing that Slow Food has put together to celebrate artisanal producers and also the biodiversity, because they also help producers not just in Italy but abroad with products that maybe are going to be possibly extinct, because as tastes become a bit more homogenized, a lot of products are lost. For example, in their international stands, there are products, for example, in Argentina, in the Andes, potatoes came from the Andes, and a lot of these potatoes have gone away, these varieties, and they're trying to help producers locally to cultivate these things, because otherwise we're going to end up with very few varieties of things, whether it's potatoes or apples, for example.
I mean, are these all merchants suffering from that? It's a contradiction that exists everywhere. When you ask people, they say, yes, I would rather shop from sort of local community artisan stores, and then they actually spend their money at the supermarkets.
Yeah, it's a problem that Slow Food has tried to address. Interestingly, in Italy 5 years ago, Eataly, this international the supermarket that's sort of, let's say, like a Whole Foods, has started up, and Slow Food has worked as a consultant to Eataly to help them get together with, link up with smaller producers that have their products on the shelf. So the products aren't, say, as expensive as going to, say, some of the high-end places, but they're still at a price point that the local producer, the small producer, can get their product to a consumer, and of course the quality is very good because there's no preservatives. It's the products that are made still in traditional ways.
And so give me a couple of examples of merchants that you've met there who are trying to preserve, I guess, slow food means of producing and consuming food.
Well, for example, in this region around Turin, in Piedmont, in the mountains, there's a cheese, Castelmagno, that's been around. The story is documented for at least 800 years, and this was a cheese that was eaten at the courts in Paris and London, the royal courts. And because of the population in these mountain villages were dissipated after World War I and World War II, there are very few people living there, and Slow Food has helped working with a few producers. There's about a handful of villagers. I've been up into these places in the mountains, about 1,200 meters, and they're helping them with marketing, not so much with funding, but helping them with marketing and certifying that the product is made still in the traditional way with the cows that graze just on the alpine herbs. And they give a product that is aged over many, many months, has these blue grain veins, very high quality. And it's something that is great to eat either when it's very young. You can have it with gnocchi, or you can have the cheese after dinner, maybe the 26-month-old cheese, with a bit of maybe port or sherry.
How much of a problem are the merchants saying is that the mislabeling or misrepresentation or indeed outright bootlegging of Italian foodstuffs? I remember we did a story on Monocle 24 earlier this year about olive oil bootlegging, which I wasn't aware up until that point was even a thing.
It's quite massive, actually. Coldiretti, this farm association, has valued that the Italian foodstuffs that are fake are in the tens of billions of euros, because people overseas see the marketability of the Italian food brand. So whether it's Parmigiano cheese, which is meant to be made in under certain requisites, becomes Parmesan. People put Italian flags on products and call it, let's say, provolone or something, or salami, when it's not actually anything like the traditional product. And in some cases, even Italian producers go to, like, for example, I know in Romania, and produce cheese and then try to sell it off as if it's Italian. Or I've bought, actually, mozzarella that was made in Slovakia in the supermarket, and I was kind of wondering, you know, the consumer maybe is in a hurry. They buy it off the shelf. They see the Italian flag, and yet they're being duped.
Is there a kind of an organized movement or lobby underway to get the Italian government to act on this?
There has been initiatives. Slow Food is very, very active on all fronts, also at the European level. And another concern of theirs is the generational turnover, because in agriculture, Italy, there's only 4% of people actually working still in agriculture. Italy has lost 5 million hectares of land to concrete and to buildings in the last 40 years. And they're very worried that in the EU overall, there's about 60% of the farmers who are at advanced age, let's say over 50, over 60. And it's a concern to them that for the next generation, what's going to happen? Because if these people aren't, if their sons or daughters or somebody else doesn't take over the farm, that might be bought up. And then you might get this problem that they've seen is that you get more industrial groups together for food. And so, you know, taste becomes a bit homogenized at that point.
And just finally, I understand that there's plenty of beer available this year with which to wash down the salami.
Yeah, you would think we're in Piedmont, a region famous for red wine, the Langhe, Nebbiolo, Barbera, Barolo. And yet I've seen in the last few editions of the Salon del Gusto, Italian microbreweries, artisanal beer has boomed. It started in this area, and it's just taken off incredibly. And Tio Musso of Baladan, this brewery, has even started growing hops and barley locally. So everything is Italian-made. Some of the flavors are a bit more exotic with cherries, and he's also thrown in a coffee flavor. So it may not be for the traditionalists, but a lot of other people have copied him, and there's a lot of microbrewers opening up, not just in northern Italy, but also there's artisanal beer in Capri, all over Italy. And so it's interesting that it's now competing with traditional land product like say, wine, for example. And it's something to watch out for.
And that was poor old Ivan Cavaglio stuffing himself at the Salone del Gusto in Turin. Coming up next, we're going to be speaking about the Lithuanian elections.
If you think the print industry is on its last legs, then you haven't tuned into The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly review of the best in paper, ink, varnishes, and glue. Every Saturday morning, we sit down with an informed group of editors, journalists, art directors, and photographers to flip through their favorite periodicals.
There's a huge amount of arrogance going into this, but it's got confidence and pride, and that makes for a fantastic end result.
It's a matter of pride to be involved in certain magazines. It's not about the reach and numbers, it's about the reach and quality.
Matte or glossy, saddle stitched or perfect bound, The Stack is an hour of opinions, predictions, and proclamations about all the titles we hoard, archive, and savor.
There is a real difference, and the difference will become more sharply edged as time goes on.
The biggest breakfast buffet of magazines and newspapers is served up every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and a passionate mix of print aficionados.
I think it's real when it's inked. You can take it home and it doesn't flicker.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture, and business. Hear from experts, authors, and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
And you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24. We're coming to you live from London, where it's 18:40. We shift our sights to Vilnius now to get up to date with developments in the Lithuanian parliamentary elections. Earlier today, the president of the Baltic Republic threatened to block a new coalition from forming in protest at the inclusion of the Labour Party, who've been accused of vote buying. Before the intervention of President Dalia Grabuskaiti, it seemed likely that the ruling Conservatives had been set for certain defeat. So where does this leave the process of forming a new government? Well, joining me on the line to explain the background to this strife and hopefully tell us what might happen next is Edward Lucas, international editor at The Economist. Edward, thank you for joining us on Midori House.
Hello, good evening.
Well, this seems like a bit of a mess, but is this the sort of normal run of things where if the sort of incumbent president doesn't like the look of the coalition he might be forming, he shouts or he squeals about vote buying? Is this normal?
No, it's not really. And I think the first thing one has to say is that Lithuania's had 4 years of quite normal politics with a conservative liberal coalition government under a guy called Kubilius, which has actually done quite a good job. It took over in the depths of the financial crisis. It had to make some very tough decisions, and it's the first government in Lithuanian history ever to fill a full four-year term. So that's quite an impressive achievement. Unfortunately, its achievements didn't include popularity, and that's why the opposition has done quite well, although actually the main change is that the opposition voters concentrated between two or three parties, where in the past it was split. So the Conservatives actually held on to their share of vote quite well, but the opposition, Labour Party and the Social Democrats and another small opposition party have all managed to form, at least on paper, a possible government.
And it says here that Lithuanian prosecutors have been trying to chat up people in prisons, for example, to make up the numbers of voters.
Well, there's a big scandal, one of many scandals, surrounding the Labour Party, which is run by a very curious fellow called Viktor Uspaskich, who is actually Russian, at least in his surname and his first language. And he's been embroiled in scandals ever since he was Minister of Economy back in 2004. And he's actually subject to criminal proceedings. And, of course, we should say, to save you from libel suits, that he vehemently denies all wrongdoing and protests his innocence. But he did at one point actually escape to Russia in order to get away from the prosecutors. Now, his party, the Labour Party, which has also been embroiled in scandal to do with party financing, has been caught on video in doing what seems to be vote buying. And this is why the president, who you mentioned at the beginning, Dalia Grybauskaitė, has said she doesn't think that the Labour Party is fit to form part of a coalition. And so that's what's precipitated the current crisis. The Mr. Uspaskich's party is quite popular with the voters, mainly, I think, just because they're fed up with every other party. It's a big receptacle for protest votes. But it's regarded by the political establishment and by most of the media as not really fit for office.
And what I wonder what the political complexion is. It seems like rather a shame after 4 years of fairly decent governance, especially I think there were big austerity measures happening in Lithuania, that this has sort of happened at this time. I suppose a moment of transition perhaps isn't what people wanted.
Well, I think it's got to give the voters their right to change things. And although the Kubilius government was very popular with the IMF and particularly with Brussels, actually, for having pushed through very dramatic energy liberalisation policy, which really biffed the Russian Gazprom pretty hard, it didn't. The voters feel fairly fed up, particularly the ones in the countryside and poorer people. There's been a lot of emigration from Lithuania. And so though, as I say, the Conservatives' votes held up and their Liberal allies held up as well, it wasn't enough to keep them in power in that coalition. But the question really now is what happens, because the likely outcome of the elections had seemed to be a coalition of three left-wing parties. That's the Social Democrats, led by a guy called Butkevičius, who's a very well-established Lithuanian politician. Second biggest in that coalition, the Labour Party, Mr. Uspaskich. And then a third party, also with a rather checkered history, called Law and Order and Justice, by a former president called Rolandas Paksas, who's actually impeached and therefore unable to run in the elections permanently. But Mrs. Grybauskaitė, who's by far the most popular politician in the country, has thrown a spanner in the works of that by saying that at least one of those parties is unfit to rule. And now everyone's scrabbling around to see what other possible combination could work. And one possibility is that the Social Democrats, who are regarded as perfectly okay, could go in with the Conservatives and form a sort of grand coalition, perhaps adding the Liberals as well. But the big danger in that is it then allows the opposition ground to be completely colonised by the so-called non-traditional parties, these sort of radical, rather dodgy parties of Mr. Uspaskich and Mr. Paksas. So that doesn't look like a very good idea, but on the other hand, they don't seem to be very much on the table.
And just finally, President Grybauskaitė was a former EU budget commissioner. Do people feel she's popular? One of the reasons she's popular because people feel that she does have a sort of decent fiscal hand on the tiller because of that?
Well, Mrs. Grybauskaitė is a very formidable figure, and she was a very effective budget commissioner, and she is by far the most popular politician in Lithuania. She has a habit of making rather erratic pronouncements on things like foreign policy, which sometimes cause some alarm in Washington and Brussels. But she doesn't actually have a constitutional power to determine who should be in government, although she can make life very difficult for a government that she doesn't like. So she's in charge. She's got her own election, presidential election, coming up in 2014, and Lithuania is going to be president of the EU in 2013, second half. So there's a lot of pressure to have a government which is going to be able to run that presidency properly, and also for Mrs. Grybauskaitė, one that will be a springboard for her to win another term as president. So plenty to watch in the coming years.
All right. So, well, Edward Lucas for the time being. Edward Lucas, international editor from The Economist. Thank you for joining us. We're going to have a song next, I think. This is Something Good by Alt J. Nice. And that is Something Good by Alt J. And you are tuned in to Midori House with me, Robert Bound, where we can give one-word record reviews like that, Steve.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
And I think it's the one word that really works for Alt J as well. It is a brilliant album.
It is a very good
album.
Awesome wave. I played that because I knew you were coming down, you see.
Oh, thanks.
Right, no. Now we should read the cue into our North Korean travel special.
Explain why I'm here.
Now, there is no more queuing at your travel agent, folks. You can now book online for North Korea's Air Koryo, also known as the worst airline in the world. It's the only airline in the world, in fact, to have only one star for safety. Our very own foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, has flown Air Koryo. Who better than our foreign editor to do so? And he joins us now, as you can hear in the studio. Steve, thanks for joining us.
That's quite right. I think one star for air safety is pushing it, really.
Is it? Tell us about the experience. So you've flown on Air Koryo a couple of times. We're doing this story, by the way. We should tell people we're doing this story because the website launched last month, I think, for Air Koryo. So you can now. I've got it up here. I'm going to book.
Okay,
you're going to try and book a flight while we talk.
Excellent.
But anyway, first of all, you've been on Air Koryo a couple of times.
Yes.
From where did you go?
Well, there's only two ways in. You can either go via Beijing or via Moscow. And so, first of all, I was going for The Independent on Sunday. This was back in 2004.
Right.
An August publication, or at least it certainly was. And the first option that the travel agent gave was via Moscow. And I thought, that's quite a long flight on Air Koryo, Moscow to Pyongyang. It's 8 hours.
Mm.
I'm not entirely sure if I want to do that. Can I go via Beijing instead? And I'm like, yeah, okay, fine. And that was only 2 hours. And it was just as well. You get on. And there are these armchairs that look like they're sort of a 1970s brown armchair. Actually looks like it is probably from the 1970s.
Yeah.
I wasn't entirely sure if the armchair was bolted down.
When you say brown,
what
sort of fabric are we talking about? Is it sort of a leatherette?
No, it's more one of those, I can't really describe it very well, one of those things that's sort of with bobbles on.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It's like the sort of seating in a sort of like Austin Princess.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Which I think is probably Googleable.
Yes.
Okay. So you get on. What are the flight attendants like? What's the sort of hospitality like? What are the uniforms like?
The uniforms, as far as I can remember, again, you'll detect a theme here, quite brown.
Right.
The food they served, quite brown. And of course, but look, to give them credit, you know, like all airlines, they offer you a free newspaper when you sit down. And so for them, of course, it was the Pyongyang Times.
Brilliant.
And it had the picture that obviously you expect on the front of Pyongyang Times, which was Kim Jong-il was obviously alive at the time. Kim Jong-il pointing at something.
Okay.
I think it was Kim Jong-il visits pig farm And then also, semicolon, inspects troops.
Nice.
It was basically what Kim Jong-il has been up to all day. And it was a good read. It kept me entertained for about 5 minutes. There were no in-flight movies. You'd be shocked to know. Although, which is a shame, because I think they're missing out on something, because North Korea actually has quite a vibrant film culture, partly thanks to the fact that Kim Jong-il kidnapped a couple of Japanese film directors.
Yeah. So they're all slightly about the same yeah. thing, but they're all very compelling.
Yeah.
And I wonder what, I mean, this now, take a look. This is the website now. And this looks kind of like...
Oh, it looks quite nice, actually.
It looks great. So we've seen the whoops.
There we are.
They've got a lovely logo, which is a sort of, which presumably is a crane, isn't it?
Yeah,
it looks an like Asian airline.
A blue crane.
It looks very similar to Lufthansa or something like that, but going the other way.
And I like how the picture of the plane on the site, it's definitely not an air choreo plane. That no way. It looks far too new and shiny.
Well, I think that's why. Maybe they've got some new gear.
I don't think they have
in the air. That's what they're doing
now. It actually looks a little bit like a missile.
That's steady.
Doesn't it?
I think you're reading too much into it.
No, okay.
Let's have a look at the uniforms here. Now this is
less brown.
This is good. This is red, white, and blue. The sort of a smart red waistcoat yeah. and skirt. Wouldn't have said it's kind of cutting edge. It doesn't look too similar to Virgin Airlines, does it?
She's not smiling though, is she?
No. No, exactly.
No.
So now while I book, I'm going to try and book
you
a flight.
You book. And should I tell you what it's like when you land?
You tell us about your return journey.
Oh, yeah. No. The return journey. Well, the return journey actually was a bit fraught because I kind of got thrown out. But that's a story for another time. When you land, Pyongyang is one of those cities without much in the way of electricity. And so there aren't many lights when you land. And
what, landing lights or just lights around the city?
I really hope there are landing lights. And it wasn't just, maybe here. No, I think there are landing lights, but around the city. Mm. And the only lights visible from the terminal lit up the two portraits of Kim Il-sung, the great leader, the one before Kim Jong-il, and Kim Jong-il. So those are the only lights on the airport terminal. You're then whisked inside. You go past the duty-free desk.
Okay.
It's a desk of duty-free, which was closed.
And what did you see in there? Did you see anything? Did you sort of peer through the
there are a couple of bottles.
Yeah.
That was it. And then they take you through security. They take your mobile phone and they say, welcome to North Korea. That's it. You can't have a mobile phone in North Korea, or certainly couldn't then, and foreigners certainly can't now. And that was it. And that's my welcome. And then when I went downstairs to the little foyer thing, I was met by a man wearing sunglasses who said, this way, and took me out into the night. That's honestly how I turned up in North Korea.
That's really
I got separated from the rest of the party I was with. They
really?
All got off on a coach, and I got in the back of this sort of rather battered old car by a man in sunglasses and two... They said they were guides.
Right.
And yeah, I got slightly worried.
Did they have a bag of trail mix?
What?
They have hiking boots?
I thought, I have no mobile phone. I don't know where I'm going. I've been separated from everyone else. I'm not entirely sure how this is going to end.
Okay, so I've just booked a flight here from Pyongyang to Vladivostok. I'm on...
oh, wow, they've expanded.
JS271. It leaves at 8:30. This is on the 9th of November. Let's click. Let's book now.
Go on.
And let's view the fare. Here we go. Now, this is... Oh, no. It's $177. That's not bad.
That's not bad, actually, from
Pyongyang to Vladivostok. Total fare, I'm not going to click on book now because I think we can do that. We can do that at a later date.
Also,
we can do that as a here's one I made earlier on the Monocle Weekly or something like that.
Well, it's good that you can do that because it used to be through a travel agent. And I'm sure this will encourage lots of people to go and visit North Korea, a country which is only too happy to welcome visitors, particularly from the West.
I think that's right. And I'm glad that you've sort of stayed in one piece after your sort of...
Yes. Yeah, it was fine. They ended up taking me to the hotel, just a slightly circuitous route. It was all fine. And the throwing out thing, I'll tell that story another time.
Tell it another time, because do you know what's happening now?
Is it the end of the show?
It's time for us to end and for me to promo the culture show, which is coming up in a minute.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Es ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Ein Monocle 24 Tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, ja, ja, ja.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Europa Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And that is all we have time for today on Midori House. Thanks to our producer, Hannah Jenkins, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Ben Jay. Up after the news is this week's spooky Halloween-themed edition of The Culture Show, presented, I think that's by me as well. And then in 3 hours' time at 2200 hours, Emma Nelson and Andrew Miller will be back with The Monocle Daily. Ted Kravitz will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Until then, thanks.